You are listening to Aloud, a program of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit us at lfla.org.
Thank you very much, Brooke. I don't need to introduce myself since you already heard that I'm Jessica Strand, the Director of Public Programming at the Library Foundation, but I will say it again. Anyway, it's wonderful to all see you here this evening for our first off-site Aloud program this fall. And we've got a couple of shows next week, one this Thursday, and in partnership with Zuccolo Town Square, and another at the Downtown Central Library on Monday. And I urge you all to come. I promise that both will be engaging and worth your time. If I am not telling you the names of both and what they are, I have a feeling that you'll probably forget them at the end of this terrific program. So instead, please check out the fall programs at lfla.org aloud. For those not familiar with the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, we are a private nonprofit organization devoted to fundraising, advocacy, and innovative programming in the support of the Los Angeles Public Library. I hope that you will consider joining LFLA to support programs like Read Baby Read, Career Online School, Adult Literacy, and Tech to Go, which gives anyone with a library card the ability to take out a Chromebook and a hotspot. If joining LFLA is not in your budget right at this moment, join the Los Angeles Public Library. It's free, and the beauty of public libraries is that they are open to everybody. The 73 neighborhoods across the city all have, the Los Angeles Public Library serves millions of residents. There are 73 branches across the city. Each branch provides space to work, a space to think, and a space to learn without any conditions or questions. Everyone, regardless of their situation in life, is welcome. There are those lucky writers who pole vault into our public consciousness seemingly overnight, though they've been writing and publishing for years. George Saunders is one of them. Though he did win a MacArthur in 2006, it was in 2013 with the publication of the 10th of December that things shifted. All who hadn't heard of George Saunders suddenly did. The New York Times Sunday Magazine cover read, "George Saunders has written the best book I've ever read." It was at this time I was lucky enough to introduce him at the Strand Bookstore in New York City. I wish I had my notes and remembered what I had said about his prose. Though his new book, Liberation Day, is tonally a bit different, his humor, sense of satire, and sublime absurdity is intact. Saunders is able, like few others, to give his characters their own language, their own voice, while keeping them grounded in the ordinary American vernacular. As Saunders wrote in an article for The Guardian in October, when we read a story, we are doing something that comes naturally to us. But under more amenable circumstances, with more time to reflect than in real life, as in those slow motion fight scenes in The Matrix, things happen more slowly in story world, and we, like Neo, are invested with new powers to observe at our leisure, to expand our capability for sympathetic compassion, to learn that there is always more to take into account, and that in doing so, we are always, always the better for it. George Saunders is the author of 9 books, including the novel Lincoln in the Bardo, which won the Man Booker Prize, and the story of collections, Past Aurelia, and the 10th of December, which was a finalist for the National Book Award. He has received fellowships from the Lannan Foundation, the American Academy of Arts and Letters, the Guggenheim Foundation, and in 2006, he was awarded a MacArthur Fellowship. In 2013, he was awarded the Penn Malamud Award for Excellence in Short Fiction and was included in Time's list of the 100 most influential people in the world. He will be in conversation with Nick Offerman, who is an actor, comedian, and writer. He has also a long list of books he has written. His books include the New York Times bestselling, excuse me while I find my note, best-selling Paddle Your Own Canoe, One Man's Fundamentals for Delicious Living, Gumption, Relighting the Torch of Freedom with America's Gutsiest Troublemakers, and Good Clean Fun, Miss Adventures in Sawdust at the Offerman Workshop, as well as co-authoring The Greatest Love Story Ever Told with his wife, Megan Mullally. Now, for the moment you've been waiting for, please welcome George Saunders and Nick Offerman.
Check, check. Oh, mine's on. Good evening. I'm Nick. That's George.
Hello.
And welcome. Thank you for that generous introduction. I'll round off what you said with one more book that was my last, called Where the Deer and the Antelope Play, the first third of which details a hiking trip with George and the third member of our bromance, Jeff Tweedy, of the band Wilco, who couldn't be here with us tonight, but he will be represented a little bit later via me. And so, I mean, it seemed worthwhile to reestablish why George and I remain friends. I met George interviewing him for my second book, Gumption, the Relighting the Torch with American Muckrakers. George was one of those muckrakers. And I'm very grateful to be here with him today.
We met in New York, and we had about a six-hour, like a sophomore in college, like conversation. We roamed all over the city, and I kind of fell for the guy, I admit it. Also, I want to make a little announcement. Did anyone see Nick on John Oliver last night? It's amazing. If you go home tonight, I beg you, look it up. It's about a 30-minute segment by John Oliver on voter suppression, and Nick brings it home so beautifully, and it's a one for the ages, really.
Thank you. John Oliver is the greatest, and I'm very. This particular episode is poignant as always. And I was lucky enough to be a hirsute cherry on the cake of his clever 30 minutes. Before we dive into some heavy scholarly rap, may I see by a show of hands, it's always interesting, especially late in your book tour, how many of you have read this book already?
It's like a pop quiz.
Okay, smattering. Good, good. Okay, so... The rest of you, you'll want to hold your ears for a lot of this. So when you kill that baby, and when the bus goes careening off the cliff. So thank you first and foremost. I mean, as a fan since the beginning, I've always been thrilled with your stories and your. Wonderful book, The Brain Dead Megaphone, of nonfiction pieces and your reportage. We're all, I think, the most familiar with George's talent with fiction, but something that I think really colors your writing is your ability to go on everyman adventures. And you've written these pieces where you went and lived at a homeless camp in Fresno. You anonymously toured a bunch of the border of Texas and Mexico, and spent some nights with some Minutemen, and got to know the humanity in all these people, which you do such a great job of infusing your stories with, and so as a longtime fan, you had this big hit book with the 10th of December, and then you. You took this weird jazz fugue solo with Lincoln and the Bardo and sort of created your own novel form and were rightly much lauded for it. I agree with all of you clappers. It's astonishing, and I'm gratefully one of the 166 cast members. Is that the right number?
Yeah, yeah.
The audiobook has 166 people. And we both got to, we're two of them.
Yeah.
And a great producer named Kelly Gilday,
who's here tonight somewhere. Kelly, you want to put your hand up, maybe?
She produced.
Unless she didn't show up, that would be kind of weird. Yeah. Oh, there she is.
There was, yeah, there was a brief, just a flash.
She's a legend. She's a legend.
It won whatever the trophy,
the Audi.
The Audi won Best Picture that year. And rightly so. And then you took another left turn and sort of turned your Syracuse teaching syllabus into a creative and fun book about storytelling through the eyes of a selection of Russian fiction
writers.
This is
the best night of my life.
Yeah. And how about this? How about his top? What a, you know, look at the way he's rolled the sleeves. I mean,
bring it.
Which, and to be honest, I'm admittedly pretty simple-minded and happily so here as I approach the autumn of my years. And so when you told me about the Russians book, I was like, this sounds like school, man. Yeah. And it was like school.
It was like school.
But it turned out to be one of those textbooks that is so fun and engaging that you think, why the fuck isn't the rest of school like this book? And I was also mad because George had me read a story in that audiobook. And the way that these things go, sometimes the cart gets out in front of the horse, sometimes they're still paving the road that we're both trying to make our way down. And so there was some hurry to it, to the scheduling, so I had to go in and record the story, the Russian story, which I read through a few times and did my best. And then only later did I receive an early copy of the book, in which George basically explains exactly how I should have performed the story.
No.
And so I apologize.
No, you nailed it. It was perfect. And that's the hardest story to read.
There's no need to over egg the pudding. We're all still friends here. But so, you know, there's been some diversification going on with you. And so all of which is to say, what a wonderful and delightful sense of relief came over me as I read this new book of stories to discover that, by God, you've still got it.
Oh, thank you.
Do you mind if I ask you a few questions?
Sure.
About the book?
Go ahead.
One thing that jumped out at me is the fun you seem to have. There's a couple of elements that seem to repeat. Mm-hmm. In some of your stories. For example, suspending human beings either from a clothesline situation or hung on a wall with some sort of audio technology built in.
That old trope. Yeah.
Yeah. which is it's pretty, you do a great job. I guess you leave the technology vague enough that it's like, oh yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah,
I get it.
Yeah.
You play them like a symphony. Yeah. Rad. And so in the title story, Liberation Day, there are characters that get hung on a wall, and they're sort of purchased like Bose speakers, like smart speakers, yeah. I guess. That are reminiscent of the Asian Girls and Semplica Girl Diaries. And then in the story Ghoul, there's sort of a theme park element to it, which seems is something that you just can't get enough of, apparently. Yeah. So, smacks of a lot of Civil War land. And I mean, you've had at least a few.
Oh, yeah.
Theme park. So would you speak to your love of these elements and why you keep returning to them?
Yeah, I mean, I think the main thing for me is that there's this quote, and there's some question about who actually said it. It was supposed to be Einstein, a student told me about it, and I could never find that Einstein said it. And so, and Story Club, this subject thing, we're having a big debate about who I should attribute this quote to, because it's not Einstein. And I could attribute it to my student, but anyway, what Einstein might have said is, no worthy problem is solved on the plane of its original conception. So the idea is, with a story, if I know what I'm trying to do, and I just do it, then everybody's let down. Because the smart reader will see it coming. You know that moment when you're reading a story and there's a little expectation cloud that comes over your head. Once upon a time, there was a dog with two heads. Oh yes, that's about a binary. Okay, and do the heads get along? You know, yeah. So you're already co-writing this story. If I just do the obvious thing, you've seen it coming for a long time, and you're let down. So for me, the whole thing of what we call craft is, how do I get myself into a fix, almost like a Houdini type fix, so I honestly don't know what I'm trying to do. It's not as easy as it sounds, because your mind is always making thematic projections. So one of the ways that I found to do that is to try to make an excuse to generate a really crazy voice that I don't know where it's coming from. It's just kind of free association voice. It's a voice that should be fun to do. It should be funny. It should be improvable. So I can write 3 pages and then cut it down to a nice crisp half a page or something. And then only at the end of that, my mind goes, okay, so who's talking? And why is he talking so weird? And so the plot might be considered the process of trying to figure that out. But the trick is to never get so far ahead of it that I actually know. So it's a little bit like if you're on a bus and the driver was drunk. Everybody kind of moves to the front a little, like, oh, is he okay? You know. So I think that's the writer's role, is to confuse himself enough that every step forward in the story feels to the writer like a discovery. So that voice is part of that. And then the other thing I do is I just go back to these tropes because I know they're fun. Like theme parks, you know, when I was younger, I had this Hemingway fixation. So everything was very Hemingway-esque, although it didn't really match with the life I was living, which, you know, like, Nick walked into the theme park, you know. Nick walked into the Walmart, it was pleasant. So what I had to do is, if I put it in the theme park, then the thing became comic. So for me, it's kind of going back to those tropes and then saying, okay, I have to use this familiar terrain, hopefully anyway, to do something new, you know. So it might just be that I have a little tiny talent and I'm just trying to use every centimeter of it by constantly repeating myself. Or by just constantly saying the same thing over and over again.
You make a fair point. I love that. I suppose a popular and innovative musician could, you know, would also sort of begin in the same, you know, like, well, it's another waltz, but yet it's surprising and delightful.
Yeah, and you've put the time in on the waltz. So I guess the thought is, you know, I've been writing stories since I was about 19. So I guess the idea is, whatever artistic form you loved first and best, the subconscious is happy when you go there, and it knows some things that it might not know in another form, you know. But it must be interesting for you, because you have done such iconic parts. And when you step into a new role, then suddenly people are bringing those other roles with them, right? Is that a challenge for an actor? You've got your legacy, your work behind you.
I was hoping things would come around to me. finally, I've been sitting here wondering when I was going to get to talk. Yes, sure. I mean, I think anybody, human beings, have a bag of tricks. You know, you learn what works, what charms people, whether it's in a story or in a role or in a classroom or in bed. we'll save that for another.
Let's do.
but yeah, I mean, for me, it's because I have a bag of tricks. The couple roles that I'm perhaps best known for, if I'm essaying a new project and something comes up, and it can be as simple as like flipping a burger on a grill, where I'm like, hang on, that's gonna send up some red flags. Let's change it to a bratwurst or what have you. But so extrapolating on what you just said, this is the first time it was fun that I got to read a new book of stories with a homework element of like what does this make me think about that I want to ask you about. And so I noticed something that I love that you do throughout history is take people, usually, you know, every person's, every man, every woman, and every gender nonconformings, every they's, is that a thing yet? And you put them in circumstances, a theme park or a workplace or a relationship that is somehow dehumanizing or it's a clamp, it's a cage of some sort that you sort of lay on top of them, but then the way their humanity insists on squirting out despite their circumstances, especially in the way that it leads to what I think is perhaps one of your greatest superpowers, is your ability to write like fragmented, wrong syntax and have it be so understandable. Like, it always feels to me like, oh, how does he know? How does he know how I talk wrong?
Yeah, that's there is a. It kind of goes back to the previous question too. That there's something that I love. It's Flannery O'Connor said, a man can choose what he writes, but he can't choose what he makes live. Which is such a, you know, with my students, that's always a powerful thing because everybody wants to be in a certain lineage. So I didn't really start out saying, I'm going to be the master of shitty syntax. You know, I wanted to be like Chekhov or something, you know, or Tolstoy. And I also didn't really think of myself as I didn't want to be a humorous writer because I didn't read any. I only read the serious, you know, modernists. But then there was a critical moment in my life where I was doing that and it just, nobody wanted to read it, including Paula, my wife. I mean, it was just so, you know. So then under duress, you start the panic of artistic desperation. I kind of lurched over to be funny, and suddenly I was getting heat back, you know. Likewise, when I started kind of channeling Chicago a little bit, like in Chicago, the humor was, oh, you know, and where we grew up, like, what, 40 minutes apart or 30 minutes apart?
Yeah, 25 minutes.
So the Chicago sense of humor thing is different. You know, like I don't know if I ever told you this, but my dad, we had these neighbors who lived next door, and they were a couple, and we didn't really know them very well. They were kind of quiet. So her mom passes away. My dad goes to the funeral, of course, being polite, and he says, you know, she lived to be 94 or something, so he says to her, you know, I'm very sorry for your loss, but, you know, your mom seemed to have had a very long, healthy life. And the woman goes, yeah, this is the sickest she's ever been. So that's Chicago. And also, my dad came home so tickled by this, you know, just so anxious to tell us about it, you know. But then also in Chicago, a lot of my uncles and the neighborhood men, they didn't speak straight in a straight line. They weren't articulate in a traditional way. So if they wanted to praise you, they didn't say, George, I'm very impressed with the way you're so studious. And, you know, they just you got moxie, you jag off, you know, and I knew what it means. He loves me, you know, so I worked a corporate job, same kind of thing where we were writing reports for Kodak about environmental problems, but we could never say it straight. It always had to be, you know, certain levels of contaminants indicate that further study may be indicated and that residences might want to be vacated, you know. So somehow that became like American poetry is avoidance and denial, but real emotion coming through a crimped opening, you know.
Oh, man. That's so satisfying. I was at a conference recently. You've reminded me of two things. Eric Holder, the former attorney general, was there speaking. And it was a small group of pretty open-minded people, and he was sort of describing some of the hardships of his job when he was serving under Obama, and he said he'd be sitting in a hearing, and he kind of looked around and said, "This is a friendly room, right?" And we said, "Yeah." And he said, "I'd be sitting in a hearing with that dipshit Louis Gohmert," and he would be just throwing ignorance at me, and I would be thinking, man, fuck you. And I mean, it was the most satisfying thing I've ever heard from a government official. And he said, and then he would finish talking, and I would have to say, well, I find some inconsistencies with the policy that you're putting on the table. Yeah. And just to hear him unequivocally say what he's thinking when you hear inconsistencies, you know
Well, this is one of the things that fiction, I think, you know, like in this time where there's so much information coming that's superficial and laced with agenda and agitating via, say, social media, fiction is, as Hemingway said, it requires a built-in bullshit detector. So if I'm writing a story and I say, Jim crossed the lawn, the freshly cut lawn, which, as it always does, smelled like gasoline, you go, whoa, wait a minute. And you go back and read again. That's weird. But if you read Tolstoy describing the way a harness is put on a horse, and he really knew that stuff, you find yourself believing it, and you find yourself drawn in. So the magic is, one, you're connecting with Tolstoy, and because he's telling you the truth. Two, you're connecting with truth. And as you were saying, what can often happen is we start in a certain position relative to our characters. And in my stories, it's often the reader and I are looking down on this schmuck, and we're having a pretty good time. Yeah, people are like that, aren't they? They really are. They're so weird, you know? But because the story can't stay static, that's against the rules, then I have to go back the next day and look at that person again. And the basic authorial stance is to say, okay, I know I was a little hard on you yesterday. Is there anything you'd like to tell me? And she goes, yeah, I got arthritis, asshole, you know? And you go, I'm sorry. Let me put that in the story. So now, since we were together yesterday judging her, now we're together again, and now you know she has arthritis, and you just heaped shit on her. Suddenly, your early facile judgment has been undercut. That's handy. And second of all, you've learned that you make easy facile judgments, and you kind of resolve not to do it again until the next section, when we find out she's in the opposite political party we are, you know. So that process in the Chekhovian model, that goes on for the whole thing. And by the end, you're in that holy state of befuddlement where you really don't know what you think for about, you know, maybe a minute or something. But you now know that you can be in that state. So that's what I've come to crave as a writer, is putting myself into that position where this long path of the story has led me for a few seconds to drop all my easy answers and just go, ah, wow, life, jeez, you know.
Yeah. I mean, you've reminded me of the way your stories make me feel, because they do, they're complicated, you know, and you do a great job of just when you think I've created, you know, some sort of expectation of where you're going. It's like, no, but people are also, you know, they'll surprise you. They'll be this. With generosity, or they'll be, no, this one's petty.
Yeah, right.
And, or this one just died.
Yeah.
She just fell over and died. how you like that, buddy? You know?
that happens. You know?
And it is, yeah. No, it really, there's a wonderful sense of, like, the voice in my head being like, life does that shit.
Right.
God damn
right.
it.
Yeah.
The other thing you just made me think of, which I think is such a great life lesson, especially that I've always adhered to in show business. When I was young, I would have peers, and you see this especially with young actors, but with older actors too, that would get headshots back when headshots were a thing. That would be not what they were, not what they were going to get cast as, but what they wished they were going to get cast as. Like, you wanted to be Hemingway. This one roommate of mine would get these. He's a great character actor, like a Steve Buscemi, like great character actor, and he just wanted to be a fucking leading man, like badass. And he would, like, spend all of his money on Rogaine and Italian shoes and headshots. And we were like, hey, you are the most incredible dork. Like, if you could just be okay with that, you will then thrive. But he was not okay. And it's what you said is, feel where the heat is coming. Whatever you're doing in your life, if you're trying to write or act or bake, whatever people spark to, you know, even if it's not what you dreamt of. I thought I was going to be Batman. And they were like, no, you're like a weird beefy plumber. Yeah. And I'm like,
all right. I think you could be Batman.
Well, I appreciate that.
Yeah.
Hopefully, if someone prints up this evening, that'll be the headline. Have we considered Offerman?
But that's the thing, you know. The joke I always make is if you wanted to be Shostakovich, and you wrote these minor keyed string quartets and you played them and everybody dozed off, and then you picked up the accordion and everybody danced. At some point, you're gonna go, okay, I'll play the accordion, because it's unpleasant. It's unpleasant when people don't like your work. You know,
it really is.
When I wrote a book called La Boda de Eduardo, which is a 700-page novel about a wedding I went to in Mexico when our kids were little, and the whole family sacrificed so I could write this stupid book, and I gave it to Paula, and I gave it to her, and I said the thing you always say, which is, no rush. You know, it's just whenever you get to it, let me know what you think, but I'm pretty confident about it. And she got to work, and I looked in, and she was 2 minutes later, like, fuck. She must have been on page 5 or something. And so that was the period where everybody, you know, people would say, I read your story. I did. It's clear you've really worked on it, you know, like that. And nobody, you want to be beloved. You know, I tell my students, you don't want to be interesting. You want to be beloved of the people, you know.
Yeah, you want them to dance.
Yeah, that's right.
I think the accordion is the original. Is it the accordion or the bagpipes of the quote? A gentleman is a person who can play the accordion, but doesn't.
You could also sub in the banjo, I think. That would also...
Sure,
you know,
yeah. But all wonderful instruments.
Yes.
Now, there in one of the stories, the Battle of Little Bighorn and Custer's Last Stand plays a role. I hope that's not too much of a spoiler. And... With your special sauce, with your particular panache, you infuse that historical event. You take us into several of the characters, you know, in that drama, and allow us to know how it played out in an entirely new way from several perspectives, which I was so, like, again, I wish. What did I write? Like, history class should be rewritten by George Saunders, because it's what I love about, and I didn't prepare this name, but the great biographer whose George Washington biography and whose Hamilton biography, Edward. Thank you, Chernow.
Yeah, on Chernow.
That's what I loved about his George Washington biography, is he got his hands on all of these letters that had become available for the first time. And when you humanize these people, like when you put him freezing in Valley Forge or whatever, and he writes a letter that's like, it's cold as a motherfucker here. Yeah. And you're like, oh shit, I never thought about you know. And you do such a great job of that. Would you please talk about, first of all, was his horse really named Vic?
It was named Vic.
Custer's
he
horse.
Had several, but that was the one that was he was riding that day. Yeah.
So, yeah. I mean, how did you, you know, it reminded me of the way you talk about how you created the historical, in quotes, portions of Lincoln and the Bardo. How did you work up that? Yeah. Piece of Custer's history.
You know, I went there after our hike in Glacier. I took a detour, and that was the first time I'd been there. I spent a couple of days there, and it was amazing, that place. This is just a sidebar. When I wrote Lincoln and the Bardo, and it was a success, and that was great. And then I immediately was like, oh, God, what do I do now? What do I do next? So one night I was asleep, and I had a dream of what the next book would be. And it was one of those long, vivid, like, dreams where you can just see the shape of the book and the chapters, and it was similar, but it was building on it in this really beautiful way. So I didn't want to forget it, so I just rolled over, and I wrote the title on a post-it note by the side of the bed, went to sleep, tomorrow I begin, you know? But tomorrow I woke up, and it said, Custer in the Bardo. my heart just dropped. But I had been researching Custer. When I was in grad school, I had a wonderful teacher of Victorian poetry named John Deal. And I had really just like fallen off the turnip truck. I came from West Texas. I wasn't an English major. I had a even more of a, this is an attempted mullet, but I had a genuine mullet. And I think he took pity on me. So he would call me Custer. He'd say, "Boy General, what do you think about Gerard Manley Hopkins?" You know, and at that time I was so insecure that he just saw me. That was really nice. And he recommended Evan Connell book called Son of the Morning Star. So I started researching Custer in the 80s and just been reading ever since. Kind of like with Lincoln, just any time I had a chance, I'd read about it, make a note, and remember it. So then after I decided not to write Custer in the Bardo, I had all that material. And a real fascination with it, you know. So I'm writing this sci-fi story, and in the story, there needs to be a performance by these people who are hanging on the wall. And I just thought, and this is something I'm kind of proud of, because at this advanced age, adventure is hard to find, you know. And I thought, I'm gonna do Custer. I'm gonna put Custer in that sci-fi story. And a little voice said, "That's not gonna work. That's random." And I'm like, "Exactly. We're gonna put it in there. We're gonna revise it for a year and a half, and we're gonna find mystery tendrils, you know." And I think that's what happened. I hope so. But yeah,
it is. I mean, I love that. You know, if there's one thing I've learned from my tutelage at your feet is what
could that be the name of your next book? My Tutelage at Your Feet.
Sure. Yes.
The George Saunders story.
My tutelage at your feet.
I think that's a commitment.
My time with George.
Yeah.
it's when that voice says, "That's not going to work." That's when you're like, "Oh yeah?"
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And it's pretty wonderful. I mean, it's what you do with it, the sort of technology that you create, the new cultural genre that you create in this person's this family's home, Untermeyer's.
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 Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Is pretty wonderful. You're gonna have a whole new take on Custer.
But can I say this is something that I, you know, we've been friends for probably what, 9 years or something.
Yeah.
But this is something that I so appreciate about that friendship, because you have one of the most energetic, generous, playful, creative minds I've ever met. And so just following you around and watching the way that you take on new tasks. No, seriously. So because I'm a little bit, I've got the inner nun, you know. So if you start doing too good, she goes, "Sit down." You know, another book? Okay. You know, like that. So, but to watch you and Jeff and to watch the way that you not only do your creating, but also the way you interact with people. I'll tell you how you're like Chekhov. May I do that?
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah, it's about goddamn time.
So here's what happened. So Nick is incredibly recognizable, right? I mean, so we were hiking in Glacier. Everyone recognized Nick, much to Jeff and I's consternation at some point. But so you're in the middle of this glacier. There's nobody around. In the distance, there's a tiny figure approaching. He comes closer and closer. Closer, closer. Some geese fly over. Closer, closer. "Are you Nick Offerman?" And this happened. And so first, the incredible grace, always sweet, always sweet. But the thing that really impressed me was, every so often, somebody would come along and go, "Can I get a picture?" And Nick always says very sweetly, "Yes, but please tell me your name first." And what happens in that moment is this person who is feeling a little weird about being so aggressive suddenly remembers himself and goes, "Oh yeah, I'm a person. My name is, you know." Nick shakes his hand, a little talk, "Where are you from?" And you can see the guy, or girl, but mostly guy, but relaxing into himself. So this is something, Chekhov did this. There's a famous story about two women coming to meet the master, Chekhov, and they were very nervous, they're provincial women. And they come in and they have all these pompous questions about the immortality of the soul, and, you know, and Chekhov kind of takes pity on them, and he says to one woman, "Which of the two of you makes the better pie crust?" And they're country women. And she says, "Well, not to be immodest, but well," and they disagree and they talk about pies. And suddenly, one of the women writes afterwards, "We were ourselves in front of the master," you know? So that's a quality that you have, and I try to emulate it every day. Yeah.
Well, I must have had a very lucky day that day.
No.
I appreciate it. I mean, it's weird. I'm tacitly involved with everybody, in what technology has done to us, and that includes what smartphones have done to us, and my becoming, as it were, my quickening in Highlander terms, took place right as social media sort of swept the world, and so I was an object of desire when people were like, oh, now I have not only a camera at all times, but a picture with someone from a TV show is a certain commodity. And it really made people weird, and it still does, where people will approach, and their opener to a stranger is, can I get a picture? And I'm like, let's back up a second. I'm not a zoo animal. And I do, you know, I do. But I will say, if I'm eating, I have bitten people. There are times when I say,
space? We've talked about kindness and that idea, and I think that was an interesting moment when that happened, because I thought, you did that guy a kindness by saying, no, actually, you don't get to lose yourself. You are a fully autonomous person, and now I'm going to remind you to come back to yourself. I thought about that a lot since. It was kind, actually.
Well,
you know.
I appreciate it. You
didn't have to hit him.
No, but I didn't. But I was feeling my oats. You know, that's one of our things. We, you know, despite being human, we try to figure out how to be kind as much as we can. A quick sidebar that's pretty funny. Later in my book, I go on a trip with my wife, Megan, and we're also driving around and hiking in state parks and national parks. Our trip was just before the pandemic. And then Megan and I, our trip was during the pandemic. So generally, and it was pre-vaccine. So when I was often hiking out by myself, and when you would approach people on trails in the woods, everybody would put a mask on. Like, they'd see each other coming. It was before we knew, you know, it was when we were still just terrified. And I would come home from a hike and say, God, wearing a hat, wearing sunglasses, and a mask, and people are still recognizing me. And Megan would say, well, did you say something to them? I'd say, not really. I mean, all I said was, good afternoon. She slapped me across the face.
You got to work on that.
Speaking of our friend Jeff, how crazy that we get to be friends with Jeff Tweedy.
It's pretty nice.
I mean, he is the most beautiful poet, musician, philosopher, king, you know, living in our country. Like, in my realm of who I know about, I'd pick Jeff.
Yeah. And he likes us.
And he likes us. When we were texting today. We have a three-way text, and we...
And actually, you know, during the early days of the pandemic, when no one knew what was going on, that guy suddenly, he went into a mode, and he was sending us fully completed, beautifully produced songs every day at 5 o'clock, a new song every day, for about, I think, 2 weeks or something. We just boom, boom, boom. That was an amazing thing to watch.
Yeah, yeah. And then because of a lot of this went around during the pandemic, that Shakespeare wrote some of his plays during the plague, so Jeff was going to call that record King Lear, and he ended up calling it Love Is the King.
It was astonishing because they weren't at all similar. He would just, you know, joyfully crank them out.
So we have a friend who we love very much, and tradition has it that when something like this happens, and one of us can't be here, I ask Jeff if he wants to ask George a question, and he did. Jeff asks, Is it safe to assume, given the fact that you're doing a book event with Nick tonight and not myself, I couldn't help noticing, is it safe to assume that Nick is indeed your most special friend and that I'm sort of kind of chopped liver when it comes to how you rank your pals and whatnot? Or... was Nick asked because you feel sorry for him And also because, let's face it, I'm not a strong reader.
Yeah, we have a kind of a competition. There can sometimes get a little testy on the texting if one of us seems to be preferring the other. So it's all a question of balance.
It's true.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, you know, we're on our way. We're aspiring monks, but we're you know, yeah, we're human.
I thought you were going to say we were aspiring to crowd the third person out.
No, although humorously, Stephen Colbert is trying his darndest to become a fourth.
Yeah. It's a rough life.
And I mean, he's not unworthy.
No.
But you know, it's the power of three.
Yeah.
I think that might be his greatest obstacle.
I'm not dropping out.
I'm going to pick one more question to ask you before we open it up to group questions. Oh, boy. Yeah, let's skip that one. There's a story called Mother's Day. It's a hilarious romp. It's a classic Saundersian lesson in empathy. It has elements of that sensibility of different points of view, like in Rashomon or Faulkner's As I Lay Dying, where you switch narrators. And then also a story called A Thing at Work, which is such a great title. There was a thing at work. And it reminded me of, and I asked you about this earlier today, I think maybe it was an interview that I read a long time ago, but you spoke so eloquently about how the human condition, especially when you're out in public, what we think of ourselves versus what we think of others, the general human insecurity is to think that everyone else is like super cool and got it together, and we're constantly doing these reevaluations of like, how do I look? What's wrong with me in this context and now in this context? And that's something that has always rung so true with me. And so as we're, you know, in this strange, fragmented, new place, I feel, and socially in our society, in our civilization, where for the first time in our lifetimes, disinformation is so rampant. Like, things are eroding. There are certain parts of our foundational, thought of what we thought we had agreed upon that are crumbling. Like, you see the pieces of the cliff falling into the ocean. And I would like you to say something cheery about how it's going to turn out. Okay.
All right. Yeah. Have you read my books? No, I do. I have. I mean, so my thought is what you're really working toward, if you're an artist, and certainly if you're a writer, you're trying to find a form and a style and a structure that feel really truthful to the way life feels to you. So for me, it's always seemed to me, since I was a little kid, that basically a room like this is 300 minds going, monkey minds, basically. You know, the thoughts are going. In each one of those heads, there's some sense that that person is central, that this whole movie was put here for your, you know, it started when you were first born and now it's playing out, that we're going to last forever, the people we love are going to last forever, and so on. So if you, my thought is if God was looking down, what God would see is 326 precious, beautiful, crazy thought streams going on, you know, staccato thinking. When you take this person here who's obsessing about this thing, and then you put her next to this person here who's obsessing about his thing, and they walk into the lobby and they actually bump into each other, you've got plot, basically, you know. So that, to me, is kind of hopeful because it means that whatever you have felt, somebody else has felt. Now, there are probably limits to that, but I think as a starting, since the brain is basically, every brain in here is built on the same model, it makes sense to think that what you feel, I feel, or can feel. And that's kind of the basis of fiction, is if I'm doing a 90-year-old woman, can I do that? Sure. My knee once hurt. I exaggerate it. Now both knees really hurt, you know. So this is kind of like, you know, if every internal combustion engine works the same way. You know, they've got ignition and exhaust and all that stuff. If you could put a loop inside the car so the car could have feelings, you would kind of assume every car kind of feels the same way. When they start to run out of gas, like, uh-oh, you know, or when they're up at full RPM, like, I love this. So, and what, you know, and I say first love. Everybody who's lucky enough to have had a first love kind of knows what that is. That feeling of like sort of going a little insane for the first time, your body coming alive, the whole axis of the world, you know, that something funny, what is it, that something funny dance, I'm trying to think of that song, the Joni Mitchell song. Anyway, the fizzy something dancing way you feel when every fairy tale comes real. Thank you. I've looked at life that way, loved that way. But that feeling is, it's weird that everybody in the room has a corollary to that. So that's, to me, the basis of literature. And it means that even people that we don't like, people who are behaving irrationally, even cruelly, we're on a continuum with them, theoretically, you know. Now, does it always save the day? It doesn't. We know that. But for me, as a way of keeping myself less anxious and therefore more useful, that's why I write fiction, so I can go into that space and go, even though I don't get you, even though I don't like you, I'm going to try to understand you. I may have to give up at some point, but when I do, I'll be in a more advanced state of mind, maybe, something like that. Is that cheerful? I don't know if that's cheerful enough.
It is. I mean, that when I get into these conversations with friends, that's always my ending is, well, it's infuriating. It's a puzzle that I don't have a solution to, yeah. But what I do know in this... We share a love of Wendell Berry, and one thing that Wendell talks about is look around you, figure out the good work that needs doing, and start doing it.
Yeah.
And you'll feel happier as soon as you do. And so whenever, you know, I just think, okay, I want to pull my hair out. I've encouraged people to vote. And now I look at what I have in front of me for homework, and I think, okay, I'm writing a little thing for a magazine. I'm going to try and make it funny. And one thing I do is choose not to do things when offers come my way. I got offered a show recently that was like a conventional procedural that is going to be like a really slick, cool, violent show. Hmm. And I was like, no, thank you. I don't feel like this is helping.
Right.
To each their own. Some people love horror or whatever, but for me, that doesn't fit into my definition of medicinal, or the sort of Aristotelian reason, you know, that I got into theater in the first place of like, and so that's how I keep myself from driving through the windows of the CVS.
Yeah. No, that's beautiful. There was in Tolstoy's last book, he's got the Resurrection. He's got this line, something like, and it's of course it's impossible to live into this, but he says, never move a muscle except in love. Never do anything. Never interact with, you know, at great cost. Never interact with another human being unless it's from a place of love. It's impossible. But I love that idea. You know that.
Sure.
And so it's an aspiration anyway.
Yeah. It is. Thank you. You always move me, and you know, baffle me. When I first read you and then met you, and you're such an easygoing, normal seeming person, it's disarming. Like the first time I met you, you clapped your arms around me and gave me a big hug, and I thought, what a wonderful world.
It's the dizzy dancing way you feel. I couldn't come up with that. Yeah,
I don't have that Joni Mitchell line. My wife would.
Yeah.
We have some time now to open up to any questions in the audience, if you have some. There's a couple of microphones floating around. You know how this goes.
How wonderful. Your friendship has been such a delight that you've shared it with us. How beautiful. I'm here to ask George a question. I'm such a big fan. I was a longtime fan, and then I was so surprised to learn that you were practicing Buddhist. I don't know if you identify in that way. I'm also a committed student of the Buddha, and of course, I can really see in your writing it made so much sense to me, but I would love to know from you personally how this informs your writing, your process in any way. Yeah.
Sure. I mean, I'm a little bit in a lapse at the moment, just to be honest, you know. But I, the first thing I noticed when I started meditating and writing was that I should never do it right before, because I would meditate and I would pick up the story and go, oh, yeah, it's so perfect. It's, you know, it's all spelled wrong, but that's cool, you know. But more seriously, what I noticed when I was in a period of meditating more intensely, it was interesting. It was just the process of becoming marginally more aware of what was habitual in my head. So I have a pretty sarcastic kind of preset, I guess. You know, I'll go to a party and I'll start thinking of things I could mock about it, or, you know, lightly mock. Likewise in a story, I'll get into a story and start going, let's drive this car into the ditch, you know. So when I was writing Lincoln and the Bardo, I was meditating a lot, and I just noticed that I would get to a certain point and some habit would say, go this way. And I'd say, well, actually, that's just a habit. What if I don't? And then weirdly, something else would present that was often more like capacious or open or interesting. So that was almost like if you habitually, you know, when you were walking, you always kind of went a little to the left, and you thought that's just how walking is. And then one day you went, oh, that's just it. I mean, it's in a habit, you know. So that was the most interesting thing to me. And those choices tended to be, I think, roughly more positive. They were more admitting of positive experience, which was cool, you know. So, yeah. Gotta get back to that.
Thank you, and thank you for using the word capacious. It's a fucking delicious word. I have a lyric where Megan says that she has a capacious anal cavity. It's a plastic Jesus. It's not untoward. Yes, ma'am.
No, of course it isn't.
That's a tough comment to follow with a question, but earlier you mentioned that you had been writing a science fiction story. One of my favorite pieces by you is Escape from Spiderhead. I think that was maybe the first one that I encountered. I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about your relationship to genre and how you think about that.
Sure, yeah, thank you. My whole approach, because I started publishing late. I was 38 when my first book came out. And I just had kind of figured out how to be funny and how to be a little strange. So the one thing I try to not do is do anything that makes anxiety or obstructs me in writing. So, for example, to think about genre for me is a little dangerous, because if I say I feel this, this, and this about genre, then the next time I'm writing a story and I'm inclined to go in a direction that doesn't fit with those beliefs, I might do it, you know? So what I feel like is I put a lot of genre into my head over the years, you know, that's what I grew up on. And then I just sort of say, whatever, you know? The main thing is always to try to have some emotional power, which means if a story starts in a weird place, which most of mine do, that's fine. But by the end, I want it to do the work of the classic short story, which is to move you, and more importantly, to speak to you where you really are, you know, what's keeping you up at night, what are you really worried about? So that means sort of not thinking about genre or not genre, not thinking about funny or not funny, but just sort of saying, I'm gonna start with some weird fragment, I'm going to go exactly where the story wants me to go. And at the end, you know, if it's genre, great. If it's not, you know. But I watched a lot of genre. Star Wars, had a big experience with the first time the spaceship went over and you could see it was dented. That was a big thing. And then Jaws, I don't know if that's considered a genre, but I saw Jaws maybe 8 times in the theater. And part of that was just to sort of go, oh, so these effects are reproducible. Everybody screams at this point. Everybody laughs at this point. And even kind of that power, like I remember I was in there and there was a pregnant woman sitting on my left and a really old man on my right. And I'm like, oh, are you going to gain one or lose one here, you know? But just knowing that you could predict that was really, really powerful.
Jorge over in the side here.
Hi. So you were talking a little bit about historical research And you were speaking a little bit earlier about how a voice, your stories start with like a voice that's kind of coming from an intuitive place. And I was wondering, how do you get like that that historical research to come from a place of intuition as opposed to like, oh, this is what Custard is like, so I'm gonna try to like mimic what his voice is like in these letters? Like, how does it start to come from like an internal place?
That's a great, you must be a writer.
I am.
That's a great question, yeah. And that's, I mean, of course, the kind of obvious answer is, well, you're gonna find your way. That's the, you know. But for me, it's mostly, one is just taking so much of the history in that you just know it. Like, you could just talk about it for hours because it's, you know, and reading even the oddball books, like about Custer, there's all these, thousands of books, all kinds of strange theories and stuff about his sexual life and stuff about the fact that maybe everybody in the 7th Cavalry killed himself that day. That was sort of a rumor. So just putting everything into your head. But then I think, just like anything else, the story has to be honored. So nothing gets in there that isn't feeding the story. Does anybody here know Stuart Kornfeld? We're in L.A. Yeah, so Stuart was a friend of mine, and he had told me once this incredible thing about stories, which is every structural unit of a story has to do two things. It has to be entertaining in its own right, and it has to advance the story in a non-trivial way. So, it's, you know, you think about anything in your story, this part is funny, but it doesn't do anything. Take it out or make it do something. This part is very functional, but it has no charm. Get rid of it or make it charming. So I think once you get the history in your head, then you say, okay, forget it. Where are we in the story? We're at the place where such and such has to happen. What do I know that can feed that? You know. So in a sense, you have to be so stuffed with history that you can take even a little bit of it and use it and not feel bad about leaving the rest. Because the worst thing is when you can feel that stench of research on something, you know. His belt buckle, which was built in Buffalo in 1755, you know, then suddenly you feel the writer, you know, having research instead.
We have time for one more. Here.
Before we answer, can I just say thank you so much for being here. I am so, it's so wonderful to be with people again, and thank you for coming out. It means a lot.
Ditto.
Yeah.
Thanks so much for being here, and I've been a longtime fan since McSweeney's and Civil War Land and stuff like that. This could be a short question if I'm wrong, but I always thought there was a big influence of like Donald Barthelme and kind of postmodern writers on your work. Could you speak to any of that? Or am I wrong?
No, you're totally right. I had a resistance to that when I was younger because I just liked stuff that was realistic and emotional. And then I read, when I got to grad school, I got admitted to Houston when Barthelme was teaching there, that's what it was. And I loved his work, I didn't really understand it. This is the way it actually happened was I was admitted there and to Syracuse, and Tobias Wolff called me. I was working in a slaughterhouse at the time, and I came home and my dad says, some guy, Tobias Wolff called you. I said, what? Dad, stop it, you know, that's not, and so I called Tobias Wolff, and I had this incredible conference, and during which, to my eternal shame, I asked him if he listened to music while he wrote. That was a bad moment. But he was very patient. And then I called Houston and said, you know, I've got this offer. And they said, well, yeah, sounds like a good offer, you know. And especially his story of the school was really meaningful to me. And I think Barthelme, although he has this reputation for being kind of cerebral and so on, he's told a mutual friend of mine, of ours, that he just wanted to break your heart. So all of that stuff was designed to both account for the complexity of the world, but also break your heart. And I think his idea was you couldn't break somebody's heart unless the full rowdy world was in there, including the world of ideas. So I love his work, yeah. Yeah.
So in Cool Hand Luke, he sings the song called Plastic Jesus on the banjo. The most beautiful actor in our lifetimes, and cries while he sings the song. And I took it, and I do a bit about it on stage, and then I added some lyrics where
It's about how the plastic Jesus sitting on your dashboard is keeps him safe, and I turn it into a flask, and I hide my whiskey in Jesus, and then when I want to take it on a flight, I butter Jesus up and tuck him neatly inside my butt. And then eventually in the song, the Virgin Mary is introduced, sitting on a pedestal of abalone shell, and I wish I could fill it with something for my wife. And so we get to the point where I say, my ass full of whiskey, domestic flight. Megan says, no thank you. She'd prefer a dry white. If I only had a second savior, everything would be swell. She said, don't worry, honey, everything will be fine. I got the virgin topped up with a Chardonnay wine, and I boast a capacious anal cavity as well. Thank you so much for having us.
No.
Aloud is made possible by the Hearst Foundation, the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, the Los Angeles County Department of Arts and Culture, Errant Fox, City National Bank, the Los Angeles Public Library, and additional generous supporters of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. To support programs like this, become a member at lfla.org.